This is Festival Showcase, a weekly interview program that explores the music and the artists behind the 2016 season of the Aspen Music Festival and School, and previews upcoming performances. I'm Chris Moore. This program comes to you from Aspen Public Radio, the official voice of the Aspen Music Festival and School, and can be heard online at aspenpublicradio.org. Today, we will be talking with director Ed Berkeley about the opera season this summer, as well as with pianist Joyce Young about this evening's recital. Ed, Aspen has become a great place for opera lovers, and this is no exception. We're just in the afterglow of the Renee Fleming performance that just took place, and now we can look forward to some really great, very, very advanced, do we even call them students, some of the people that are here?
We sell ourselves this way. We are a student program, but there are a lot of singers who come here who are already started on careers, so that they're at a sort of young artist level of doing performances, and some actually quite big houses like at L.A. or New York. They're here because they have the chance to do a complete role with orchestra in a production and to develop the sense of character and who they are as performers.
And that's exactly what happened, by the way, with Renee Fleming, isn't it?
Well, that was with Renee. It's funny, when you mentioned her name just now, I went, gee, that's really, I mean, the first time I worked with her here, we were working on Transformations, the Conrad Susa opera, which was just a great experience for me, and I know it was for her, too. She talks about it. It was at a point when she was literally on the cusp, right on that edge of jumping into a major career. So it's great.
I've seen people go straight from here to winning the Met auditions. I've seen people who have won the Met auditions who are here. It really does seem as though...
Well, you know, Yelena, who was our Fiordaligi last summer, just won this spring, won the Met auditions. So it's pretty cool.
Right. And there was one time that I think I was about three seats away from James Levine, who was coming in to check out one of your singers. It's a very exciting, nurturing ground for singers who are right there.
It's also a place where people learn, is this the life they want? A lot of singers need the moment of reflection, and frankly, looking at beautiful mountains helps them think about my life as a singer. Is this what I want? Is this where I will go?
Maybe we could start by talking a little bit about your Saturday morning shows, which are so much fun every year. You have these opera scenes master classes every
Saturday.
Yeah,
I mean, it's such a funny, it's a funny thing to me. It's for many years, obviously, they've been going on. And the kids, they're not such kids, they get to rehearse and work on the music and the staging and develop an approach to the scenes. And then present them in front of a living audience on these Saturday mornings at 10 o'clock in the Wheeler Opera House. And they get to perform them. And then I work with them some to see how to help them find other layers in what they're doing and fix some things, which I find, gee, what are you doing? What's that about? Does it mean anything? And is this about your own nerves or is this about the character's nerves? Because a big thing for a lot of singers is getting past the point where their own stage anxiety is what the character is becoming instead of the character being motivating what they're doing. And so it's, I don't know if it's like feeling relaxation and performance, but also feeling they have to stay alive as human beings when they're singing.
If they're destined to have an opera career, most of their lives, they're going to have to be at their peak in the evening and late into the evening, and then they go out afterwards and have dinner at midnight or whatever. And you have this 10 a.m. performance time. You seem to be very on.
I like the mornings better, personally.
You're more of a morning person.
I'm actually much more of a morning person.
Okay.
And I've always thought that one of our services was, by doing the scenes in the morning, is that we could really interrupt people's golf rounds. And so they could come, instead of playing golf, they would spend Saturday morning with the arts. And this would be healthy in people's lives.
Right. And it must be a challenge for the singers, too, because I think if they're in that evening cycle, that night owl kind of cycle that so many artists are, then this is a way to say, whatever you're feeling inside, even if you're a little tired, you're out there in front of the audience, and you have to deliver no matter what time it is.
And they do start warming up very early in the morning. I mean, in order to be at peak, for to be in good voice by 10. And I know that a lot of them would probably be very happy if we could shift it to the evening, but I don't think so.
No. No, we're all very happy with that.
Yeah, I think it's...
And I will mention, too, as somebody who's been watching these for many, many years, every time it seems that you're infusing more energy into the performers, trying to get them to be more committed, more intense, more in love, more angry. Whatever the emotion is that's being expressed, you want it to be more operatic.
Well, and to trust themselves to let it out. A lot of them will feel it inside and think that what they're doing shows to an audience, that an audience is getting it. And somehow it's like with a little bit of encouragement, it starts to fill the space. The Wheeler is just 500 seats. So emotionally, you need to be able to fill 500 seats. Mm-hmm. I mean, someone in the back row has to feel as much as someone in the front row. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes a singer needs to know that they can trust themselves to feel something that fully to really fill the whole house.
Let's talk about the most famous opera of all time, so famous that sometimes people are sick of even hearing about La Boheme, but you're going to have young singers, many of whom have perhaps never performed in La Boheme before. So tell us a little bit about the singers that you have and what kind of freshness of approach they, the singers themselves, are able to bring to this.
Well, one of the great things for a long time is being able to do operas like Boheme, where you have characters who should be in their low 20s. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, we have a cast of singers in that who are that age.
Right.
Which means that their sense of experience and, I mean, emotional experience and life experience and hopefulness for the future, which is in the first three acts of the opera, certainly the first two acts, is so full of hope for a future and for a wonderful life and for the arts. And that's exactly where people are right now, the singers are who are doing the opera are. So that they're having the chance to express their own fears, hopes, and dreams and falling in love for maybe the first time and discovering what that all means. It always feels you get to the third act and then the very sad fourth act. It's like people growing up and realizing that you don't always get exactly your dream, and that's sad.
Yes, it is. Is there going to be some special kind of staging, or will it be pretty true to 19th century France, etc.?
It's not going to be 19th century, but it's not going to be modern either. I'm just going to stay in a period. But one of the things I wanted to explore, I've done the opera before, and one of the things I wanted to get to explore, and something that is in the libretto a great deal and in the music, is how cold it is. There's a lot of text and music that has to do with how cold they feel. The opera starts with Rodolfo presumably shivering, searching for a way to get the fire started again so that he and the friends can feel warmth. Mimi enters looking for warmth. At the end of the opera, when she's failing, she talks about the feeling of cold coming into her bones. So I wanted to get some of that sense of coldness into the production in a way. So it's something, it's like an obstacle to their finding future is the coldness itself. Which sounds weird. And to that end, quite a bit of the production is not quite black and white, I wouldn't say, but it's not garish colors. It's very, it's a very muted feeling. And then they start to find love. And obviously with love comes color and pleasure. So that sort of lets them open up more and more.
Right.
And it's sort of a side of the opera that I wanted to get to explore more.
Well, at least in the time, I don't know how true it is, that sometimes coldness is associated with sickness too.
Yeah,
you get sicker when you're not being properly taken care of in the heat department.
Although we have plenty of heat here, so I'm in an Aspen, so
it's, yeah. Well, in the summer we do, I guess.
Yeah, saying that in fact she's dying. This is not just a bad cold. It's not just she got some whatever flu or something. No, this is death. And that moment of realization is something that is shattering in the third act, truly shattering. And we see the way it affects their relationship and the way they're able to deal with each other facing death.
One of the reasons I think that this opera, La Boheme, is such a war horse, to be blunt, is also a sense of the dramatic timing. Not only is the music incredibly beautiful, but it seems to me when I watch the opera that there's just the right amount of music if somebody's supposed to walk across the stage to get them from point A to point B.
Chris, because many years ago when I was first working on opera, something that I realized working with a music director was saying, well, you know, someone has to move here because he gave us time for someone to move. And Puccini is a master dramatist. Really, and the more you go into the details of the orchestration and just the sense of time, how much he involves the stage space. So the stage action really is, it's remarkable how he imagined the movement of the piece. And I think that's part of what makes Bohème work so well, is people don't realize Bohème's a very short opera, and it's concise in telling a complicated story and very emotional story, but it's a very concise opera. He uses just enough time to say what he has to say.
The other thing is, of course, we all walk out with our hankies in our hands, but at the same time, it's one of the funniest operas out there.
Well,
the way the friends interact
is genuinely funny.
And depending on how it's directed, it can actually make me laugh out loud.
Well, I hope you do, but you know, I can't control that.
Yeah,
I can't help. But I think it'll be funny.
Ed, I know you're not directly involved in directing A Wedding by William Bolcom, but I'm sure you've had some kind of hand in it. And do you know Bill Bolcom personally?
I don't know Bill Bolcom. I don't. I mean, I was very much in favor of our doing Wedding because of being aware of the opera and his music. And we've never done one of his operas. And so I started looking at different pieces. And I think his setting of coming from the Altman film, I mean, he really caught the wonderful sense of humor of what it is to have this wedding between two families that just don't fit together. And the notion that we're in what, suburban Chicago, for a northern old money family with a southern new money family trying to mesh. And it's hard to guess if anyone actually likes each other and who's happy and who's miserable. And I just when I started looking at the different pieces, I really thought, gee, wouldn't it be great for us to be able to do Wedding in Aspen as a first piece of Bill Bolcom's? And then, of course, with Betty Bucherry, who's head of music staff for opera here, we listen to auditions and then start casting. And so then we're all over the place trying to find the right singers with the right, I think, wonderful sense of humor to play this range of characters. The funny thing is that the way he brings this different feel, it's almost like there's a moment where you feel like, am I watching Elvis? Because in trying to characterize Snooks, the southern father of the bride, it's like finding a musical vocabulary for each character means going into the different musical languages, American musical languages. So he's not limited to using a, quote, his own voice to say everything.
Right.
He finds elements from other musical vocabularies that speak for the characters. And I think it's a real gift. I mean, it's remarkable.
Well, he's always had a great melodic gift. I mean, I've heard so many of his art songs and not seen or heard any of his operas yet. So this will be
this has a good, and this is a good mix of stuff, because there's arias that are, I mean, romantic and funny, that are engaging, but then also scenes where the characters are in some very difficult music, are actually bouncing off of each other and with a real sense of humor. I love that the opera starts with the wedding planner. It's a very wry way into going to a wedding and seeing something, you know. And so this sort of domineering figure who probably is more than slightly out of control. And I think we've all witnessed that feeling of whose party is this anyway? And it's very, very funny idea.
My understanding is that Robert Altman himself, the film director, had a hand in the creation of the libretto.
Absolutely. He and Arnold did the libretto for it, and it was a very successful libretto. And which meant trimming from the film.
Of course.
Meant trimming things from the film, because I think Altman's film was something like 30, 31 or 30, some characters, separately identified characters with many incidents. And in the opera, it's down to, I think, 16 or 17 very specifically identified characters.
Altman, as a film director, is famous for sometimes having people talk over each other, just like we do in real life. It seems that in opera, there might be a potential for that. I don't know, because I haven't heard
this. There's some sections that are just like that, where it's like there's
very contrapuntal
conversations going on at the same time, and it's like, oh, I get it.
Yeah. Oh yeah, that's what Altman did too.
Well, and it's sort of it's a way of painting life and of creating its own kind of chaos. I mean, controlled and uncontrolled.
Now, when you do casting for this or any other opera, you come up with however many singers you have that you accept into the program, 60 or 80 or whatever it is, and just choose among them, or do you actually sometimes search out somebody who would be just perfect for one of the roles?
A lot of it is hearing people and going, aha, this person would be right for Rita in this opera, who's the wedding planner, or this one would be great for Rodolfo. And, you know, because we hear a lot of singers, almost 500 singers are auditioned. Then it's a matter of, in the audition process, trying to make sure that we're accepting people for the program who will fit well into the roles.
Ed, I used to have a radio opera show every Sunday evening, and I'd play entire operas. And I did play Beatrice and Benedict some 20 years ago, but I've never seen it, and I'm not nearly as familiar with this as I am with Les Troyens and some of the other great works of Berlioz. This I know is a comedy, and there's a lot of spoken dialogue in this. So it seems as though it's an odd mix. It's almost like a musical or something. What is this?
That's interesting. I mean, it's a romantic comedy. I mean, it's a romantic comic opera. It's a balance because Berlioz's wife was a Shakespearean actress, of course, was an English woman, and this was a final work. I think this is the final major work. And writing this is a kind of tribute to her and to love, and using Much Ado About Nothing as a basis. Mm-hmm. So that he had a great way to tell story, but for whatever reason, he didn't tell that much story through the music. Mm-hmm. The music itself is more exploration of character in a given situation. Mm-hmm. So he has a fair amount of dialogue, which has been, I've edited quite a bit, to tell the story.
You actually told me before we got on here about the time you did this with Colin Davis, and I think when you were at Philharmonic.
Right. The idea of that production, which Sir Colin and the New York Phil bought into, was to have a singing cast and a speaking cast. It was actually really fun. So that the singing Beatrice and the speaking Beatrice were separated. Mm-hmm. And it meant that there were sort of two different visions of Beatrice, but also two ways of feeling the story for the audience. Mm-hmm. And so it was something I got to explore there and enjoyed a great deal. And then ultimately they all got to meet within the finale. They all got to meet, which was great fun.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if that informed or inspired your directorial decisions and what you're going to do this season.
Well, yeah, I like the idea that in a radio situation like we're in now, an audience gets to fully imagine what we look like when we're sitting and speaking. We have the voice, and then an audience creates a reality of what that is.
Right.
As they're listening, every word we speak contains incredible visual imagery. So something I wanted to do with this was to have actors who were speaking the Shakespeare, essentially, and acting it as if they were in a radio play, and at the same time having the stage action happening, so that there was this kind of two levels of reality that were happening for the audience to be putting together and having their visual imagination challenged, which will do it sometimes when there's more spoken and less visual. And then when it becomes fully musical, obviously, it's completely the onstage singing that takes control of it. It means a full double cast. It's not quite. Mm-hmm. I think it's going to be a great experience for people.
And then you'll probably get to have them meet at the end again.
Oh, yeah. Well, we've got to do a reunion scene.
I mean, right. Right, exactly. Well, I look forward to hearing the rest of Beatrice and Benedict. And thank you for taking the time to open up a few doors around this. If you've just joined us, this is Festival Showcase on Aspen Public Radio, and we've been talking with director Ed Berkley about the opera season this summer. Now it's time for us to switch over to pianist Joyce Young, who's putting on a recital this evening and is also a part of the chamber music concert next Monday. Do you practice, like, I'm going to figure out this way to do it so that it's going to come out in a certain way, or do you explore all the different angles of possible ways it could be performed and then allow yourself more spontaneity that way? What's the approach that you have as a practicer of music?
When I practice, I really try to explore all options of what one passage can be, because I think in performances I constantly surprise myself, because very often I end up finding an option that was not available to me in the practice room and run into all kinds of trouble. I mean, it's a very exciting moment because it's you've discovered something, but at the same time, you think, I've never gone down that road before. I've never got to the summit taking this trail. This is a new trail. I've never been there before. So you actually don't know if you're going to make it out on the other side. If you practice it so that you're constantly exploring in the practice room, I think that readies you for any spontaneous gesture that might occur in a concert.
Is that a purely technical process, or is there a quality of self-exploration when you when you're practicing or when you're learning a new piece or even reviving a piece you already know?
I think depending on the composer, some things can be just very muscular and really trying to get your hands ready and have that brain connect with the hands. But a lot of the times it is a purely creative process. The technicality can change quite a bit depending on the interpretation. So I think I'm the kind that just hates repetition. So I'm constantly exploring, I guess, from the emotional point of view, much more heart than the head or the muscles. And I just have to always pretend that a practice room is a concert. Like each time I play for myself, I should perform for myself or the device that I'm recording on. I think that's very revealing. As soon as I put that recording device on, I start making music in a different way and listening to myself and exploring all the ways it can be. I think it's a very creative process, and I think that's why I have trouble playing so many hours in a day, because after I think maximum of 5 hours, my creativity just starts falling and it becomes about getting the notes right. And I mean, I could use those hours too, right. For sure, but it can get very monotonous after that.
Since you started out as a student, among other places, here at the Aspen Music Festival in school, I wanted to ask about teaching and how the teachers influenced you, and also if there were teachers that sometimes, as you got more advanced, would just step aside and not just pick apart every little tiny piece because they could see that you were really developing a voice, or if you felt that it was very important for them to stay at that level of picking each technical detail apart.
I studied with Jochevit Kaplinski for over 15 years, from age 11 to 26. So she's been my main teacher for a very long time. And I think what she planted in me is that everyone has a different voice. And if we work hard enough, we will grow that voice into hopefully something magnificent. But along the way, you might really grow strange branches that could lead you into a very strange direction. And that was what she was, I think, just fantastic at. She knew which branches to cut and say, Joyce, never do that again, because that makes absolutely no sense. And when to say, how interesting that you want to go in that direction. Let's explore more of that, because I think this is a very unique voice. And I will never forget this moment when I must have been about 18 or 19 years old. I brought a Chopin piece to her, and I was incredibly frustrated because I thought it was sounding awful. And she said, this is not the way I would have guided you to play this piece, but I can really tell that you've thought about every single note that you played for me today, and whether this is finalized or not, it'll probably change from this point on, but for me to change a passage and comment on it would be like removing a column out of a building, and probably every other block needs to change after that. And I realize you're creating a world that is your own, and this is the end of the lesson. So good job. And
wow.
I'm proud of you that you're thinking this way. And that just blew me away. Another teacher I studied with in Aspen was Anton Nell. And the lessons we had were so great. And I really thank him when I'm on tour these days, because I remember working on Tchaikovsky's first piano concerto with him, and I had never played it with an orchestra before, and I was spending the summer getting ready for my first performance, and I remember him speaking to me as a performer, because he had done this piece so many times, and he warned me where the oboes might be late, the horns will probably be delayed, there's a few instruments here, they will not be together, so don't be thrown off. So it was like all these wonderful advice from a performer's point of view that would have really thrown me off.
From what I have heard, Rachmaninoff may have been one of the worst teachers. The student would be playing the piano, and Rachmaninoff would smash his fists on his hands onto the piano and say, you play like a girl. And I don't think that you've ever gotten quite that sort of discouragement from any teacher, but how do you find working with Rachmaninoff? You were talking about muscularity a lot, and there's a lot of that in Rachmaninoff. And how do you like to approach Rachmaninoff as a composer with all those notes and all that volume?
it can get quite intimidating. There mm-hmm. is so many technical things that can go horribly wrong.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The challenge with Rachmaninoff, it's the emotional intensity combined with this virtuosity. So you basically have to jump off the cliff just hoping that your parachute opens.
Rachmaninoff once to a young pianist said, "Hey kid, this is a really terrible business," and warned her against even getting into it at all. And you've been in the business now for a while. You seem to be still very enthusiastic about being in the business. What is it about piano playing in front of an audience, whether it be chamber or orchestral or solo like you're doing today, that makes it worth it to you, that makes all the travel and everything else worthwhile for you as a performer?
I think first and foremost, it is an extreme high to be on stage.
Mm-hmm.
Making music is always so different that I never get sick of it. Some people say, you play so-and-so piece so many times, does it ever get boring? Are you ever on autopilot? And for me, it's always different. It can always get better. There are always points when I say, that was so much better 2 weeks ago, maybe I'm getting worse. There's always that mm-hmm. hunger for getting that message across a little bit better, a little bit clearer, a little bit more intentionally and emotionally wired. I think the worst thing would be for me to perform something I think I'm good at, but not where my heart is. It doesn't tickle me pink, but I'm mm-hmm. going to do it for the audience. And this kind of mentality doesn't work for a performer after a while. I have to do, mm-hmm. even if I sound terrible, I have to do where my heart is. And mm-hmm. I need to say that message like I mean it. So I think, yeah, most importantly, it's sticking with the repertoire that I love. And each time I am so eager to get that message across. I really do it for this absolute gold that we've been given from the composers.
You spoke about composers or works that really speak to you. Do they speak to you because they teach you something about yourself? Is that part of it? Or is it more of a, wow, this just brings in so much excitement? Or what are some of the qualities that you like in general in the music that really speaks to you?
I guess it's like meeting a person.
Mm-hmm.
You meet a person and that person brings out hopefully what you like about yourself. Hopefully there's a number of good things that you like about yourself and you become sort of a better person because of the person you met. And within that music, somehow I can have different conversations within myself and say, oh yes, of course. It's that recognition that sparks within you that you're like, oh, this music lives in me. And there has to be some kind of assurance that I can bring this to life in front of the audience.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my initial recognition with the piece. And of course you spend hundreds and thousands of hours with it. And sometimes it's not the piece for me,
right.
But you never find out really unless you spend that much time with it.
Joyce, we look forward to hearing you this evening. And then I guess you're coming back to Aspen on Monday for a chamber recital as well.
Yes, I'll be playing Dvorak's piano quintets.
Sweet. Well, thank you very much for taking the time to speak to us here at Aspen Public Radio.
Oh, great pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We've been talking with pianist Joyce Young, whose piano recital is this evening at Harris Hall. This has been Festival Showcase, a weekly interview program that explores the music and the artists behind the 2016 season of the Aspen Music Festival and School and previews upcoming performances. This program comes to you from Aspen Public Radio, the official voice of the Aspen Music Festival and School, and can be heard online at aspenpublicradio.org. Please join me Tuesdays at 3:30 or the rebroadcast Saturdays at 3 for more interviews. My name is Chris Moore. Thanks for listening.